have the delusion that they are extraordinarily powerful and brilliant, and often insist they are on the verge of some philosophical or scientific breakthrough or lucrative money-making scheme. Many famous creative individuals suffer from this illness and manage to control it with lithium. Because the disease feels so good, individuals who are having their first attack often cannot be convinced to seek treatment. The first symptoms are so intoxicating that the victim resists accepting the idea that his or her sudden acquisition of self-confidence and inner ecstasy is actually just a manifestation of a destructive illness. After a while, the euphoric state may escalate into uncontrollable delirium requiring involuntary hospitalization, or it may just as suddenly switch into an incapacitating depression with pronounced immobility and apathy. I want you to be familiar with the symptoms of mania because a significant percentage of individuals who experience a true major depressive episode will at some later time develop these symptoms. When this occurs, the personality of the afflicted individual undergoes a profound transformation over a period of days or weeks. While psychotherapy and a self-help program can be extremely helpful, concomitant treatment with lithium under medical supervision is a must for an optimal response. With such treatment, the prognosis for manic illness is excellent. Let's assume that you do not have a strong suicidal urge, hallucinations, or symptoms of mania. Instead of moping and feeling miserable, you can now proceed to get better using the methods outlined in this book. You can start enjoying life and work and use the energy spent in being depressed for vital and creative living. Chapter 3. Understanding your moods. You feel the way you think. As you read the previous chapter, you became aware of how extensive the effects of depression are. Your mood slumps, your self-image crumbles, your body doesn't function properly, your willpower becomes paralyzed, and your actions defeat you. That's why you feel so totally down in the dumps. What's the key to it all? Because depression has been viewed as an emotional disorder throughout the history of psychiatry, therapists from most schools of thought place a strong emphasis on getting in touch with your feelings. Our research reveals the unexpected. Depression is not an emotional disorder at all. The sudden change in the way you feel is of no more casual relevance than a runny nose is when you have a cold. Every bad feeling you have is the result of your distorted negative thinking. Illogical pessimistic attitudes play the central role in the development and continuation of all your symptoms. Intense negative thinking always accompanies a depressive episode, or any painful emotion for that matter. Your moody thoughts are likely to be entirely different from those you have when you are not upset. A young woman about to receive her PhD expressed it this way. Every time I become depressed, I feel as if I have been hit with a sudden cosmic jolt and I begin to see things differently. The change can come within less than an hour. My thoughts become negative and pessimistic. As I look into the past, I become convinced that everything that I've ever done is worthless. Any happy period seems like an illusion. My accomplishments appear as genuine as the false facade for the set of a Western movie. I become convinced that the real me is worthless and inadequate. I can't move forward with my work because I become frozen with doubt. But I can't stand still because the misery is unbearable. You will learn, as she did, that the negative thoughts that flood your mind are the actual cause of your self-defeating emotions. These thoughts are what keep you lethargic and make you feel inadequate. Your negative thoughts, or cognitions, are the most frequently overlooked symptoms of your depression. These cognitions contain the key to relief and are therefore your most important symptoms. Every time you feel depressed about something, try to identify a corresponding negative thought you had just prior to and during the depression. Because these thoughts have actually created your bad mood, by learning to restructure them, you can change your mood. You're probably skeptical of all this because your negative thinking has become such a part of your life that it has become automatic. For this reason, I call negative thoughts automatic thoughts. They run through your mind automatically without the slightest effort on your part to put them there. They are as obvious and natural to you as the way you hold a fork. The relationship between the way you think and the way you feel is diagrammed in Figure 3.1. This illustrates the first major key to understanding your moods. Your emotions result entirely from the way you look at things. It is an obvious neurological fact that before you can experience an event, you must process it with your mind and give it meaning. You must understand what is happening to you before you can feel it. If your understanding of what is happening is accurate, your emotions will be normal. If your perception is twisted and distorted in some way, your emotional response will be abnormal. Depression falls into this category. It is always the result of mental static distortions. Your blue moods can be compared to the scratchy music coming from a radio that is not properly tuned to the station. The problem is not that the tubes or transistors are blown out or defective, or that the signal from the radio station is distorted as a result of bad weather. You just simply have to adjust the dials. When you learn to bring about this mental tuning, the music will come through clearly again and your depression will lift. Some readers, maybe you, will experience a pang of despair when they read that paragraph. Yet there is nothing upsetting about it. If anything, the paragraph should bring hope. Then what caused your mood to plunge as you were reading? It was your thought. For other people, a little tuning may suffice, but I'm the radio that is broken beyond repair. My tubes are blown out. I don't care if 10,000 other depressed patients all get well. I'm convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that my problems are hopeless. I hear the statement 50 times a week. Nearly every depressed person seems convinced beyond all rhyme or reason that he or she is the special one who really is beyond hope. This delusion reflects the kind of mental processing that is at the very core of your illness. I have always been fascinated by the ability certain people have to create illusions. As a child, I used to spend hours at the local library reading books on magic. Saturdays, I would hang out in magic stores for hours, watching the man behind the counter produce remarkable effects with cards and silks and chromium spheres that floated through the air, defying all the laws of common sense. One of my happiest childhood memories is when I was 8 years old and saw Blackstone, World's Greatest Magician, perform in Denver, Colorado. I was invited with several other children from the audience to come up on stage. Blackstone instructed us to place our hands on a 2 feet by 2 feet birdcage filled with live white doves until the top, bottom, and all four sides were enclosed entirely by our hands. He stood nearby and said, "Stare at that cage." I did. My eyes were bulging and I refused to blink. He exclaimed, "Now I'll clap my hands." He did. In that instant, the cage of birds vanished. My hands were suspended in empty air. It was impossible. Yet it happened. I was stunned. Now I know that his ability as an illusionist was no greater than that of the average depressed patient. This includes you. When you are depressed, you possess the remarkable ability to believe and to get the people around you to believe things which have no basis in reality. As a therapist, it is my job to penetrate your illusion, to teach you how to look behind the mirrors so you can see how you have been fooling yourself. You might even say that I'm planning to disillusion you, but I don't think you're going to mind at all. Read over the following list of 10 cognitive distortions that form the basis of all your depressions. Get a feel for them. I have prepared this list with great care. It represents the distilled essence of many years of research and clinical experience. Refer to it over and over when you read the How to Do It section of the book. When you are feeling upset, the list will be invaluable in making you aware of how you are fooling yourself. Definitions of cognitive distortions. 1. All or nothing thinking. This refers to your tendency to evaluate your personal qualities in extreme black or white categories. For example, a prominent politician told me, "Because I lost the race for governor, I'm a zero." A straight-A student who received a B on an exam concluded, "Now I'm a total failure." All-or-nothing thinking forms the basis for perfectionism. It causes you to fear any mistake or imperfection because you will then see yourself as a complete loser, and you will feel inadequate and worthless. This way of evaluating things is unrealistic, because life is rarely completely either one way or the other. For example, no one is absolutely brilliant or totally stupid. Similarly, no one is either completely attractive or totally ugly. Look at the floor of the room you are sitting in now. Is it perfectly clean? Is every inch piled high with dust and dirt, or is it partially clean? Absolutes do not exist in this universe. If you try to force your experiences into absolute categories, you will be constantly depressed because your perceptions will not conform to reality. You will set yourself up for discrediting yourself endlessly because whatever you do will never measure up to your exaggerated expectations. The technical name for this type of perceptual error is dichotomous thinking. You see everything as black or white. Shades of gray do not exist. 2. Overgeneralization. When I was 11 years old, I bought a deck of trick cards at the Arizona State Fair called the Svengali deck. You may have seen this simple but impressive illusion yourself. I show the deck to you. Every card is different. You choose a card at random. Let's assume you pick the Jack of Spades. Without telling me what card it is, you replace it in the deck. Now I exclaim, Svengali! As I turn the deck over, every card has turned into the Jack of Spades. When you overgeneralize, this is performing the mental equivalent of Svengali. You arbitrarily conclude that one thing that happened to you once will occur over and over again, will multiply like the Jack of Spades. Since what happened is invariably unpleasant, you feel upset. A depressed salesman noticed bird dung on his car window and thought, "That's just my luck. The birds are always crapping on my window." This is a perfect example of overgeneralization. When I asked him about this experience, he admitted that in 20 years of traveling, he could not remember another time when he found bird dung on his car window. The pain of rejection is generated almost entirely from overgeneralization. In its absence, a personal affront is temporarily disappointing but cannot be seriously disturbing. A shy young man mustered up his courage to ask a girl for a date. When she politely declined because of a previous engagement, he said to himself, "I'm never going to get a date. No girl would ever want a date with me. I'll be lonely and miserable all my life." In his distorted cognitions, he concluded that because she turned him down once, she would always do so, and that since all women have 100% identical tastes, he would be endlessly and repeatedly rejected by any eligible woman on the face of the earth. Svengali! 3. Mental filter. You pick out a negative detail in any situation and dwell on it exclusively, thus perceiving that the whole situation is negative. For example, a depressed college student heard some other students making fun of her best friend. She became furious because she was thinking, "That's what the human race is basically like, cruel and insensitive." She was overlooking the fact that in the previous months, few people, if any, had been cruel or insensitive to her. On another occasion, when she completed her first midterm exam, she felt certain she had missed approximately 17 questions out of 100. She thought exclusively about those 17 questions and concluded she would flunk out of college. When she got the paper back, there was a note attached that read, "You got 83 out of 100 correct. This was by far the highest grade of any student this year, A+. When you are depressed, you wear a pair of eyeglasses with special lenses that filter out anything positive. All that you allow to enter your conscious mind is negative. Because you are not aware of this filtering process, you conclude that everything is negative. The technical name for this process is selective abstraction. It is a bad habit that can cause you to suffer much needless anguish. 4. Disqualifying the positive. An even more spectacular mental illusion is the persistent tendency of some depressed individuals to transform neutral or even positive experiences into negative ones. You don't just ignore positive experiences. You cleverly and swiftly turn them into their nightmarish opposite. I call this reverse alchemy. The medieval alchemists dreamed of finding some method for transmuting the baser metals into gold. If you have been depressed, you may have developed the talent for doing the exact opposite. You can instantly transform golden joy into emotional lead. Not intentionally, however, you're probably not even aware of what you're doing to yourself. An everyday example of this would be the way most of us have been conditioned to respond to compliments. When someone praises your appearance or your work, you might automatically tell yourself they're just being nice. With one swift blow, you mentally disqualify their compliment. You do the same thing to them when you tell them, "Oh, it was nothing, really." If you constantly throw cold water on the good things that happen, no wonder life seems damp and chilly to you. Disqualifying the positive is one of the most destructive forms of cognitive distortion. You're like a scientist intent on finding evidence to support some pet hypothesis. The hypothesis that dominates your depressive thinking is usually some version of, "I'm second rate." Whenever you have a negative experience, you dwell on it and conclude, "That proves what I've known all along." In contrast, when you have a positive experience, you tell yourself, "That was a fluke. It doesn't count." The price you pay for this tendency is intense misery and an inability to appreciate the good things that happen. While this type of cognitive distortion is commonplace, it can also form the basis for some of the most extreme and intractable forms of depression. For example, a young woman hospitalized during a severe depressive episode told me, "No one could possibly care about me because I'm such an awful person. I'm a complete loner. Not one person on earth gives a damn about me." When she was discharged from the hospital, many patients and staff members expressed great fondness for her. Can you guess how she negated all this? "They don't count because they don't see me in the real world. A real person outside a hospital could never care about me." I then asked her how she reconciled this with the fact that she had numerous friends and family outside the hospital who did care about her. She replied, "They don't count because they don't know the real me. You see, Dr. Burns, inside I'm absolutely rotten. I'm the worst person in the world. It would be impossible for anyone to really like me for even one moment." By disqualifying positive experiences in this manner, she can maintain a negative belief which is clearly unrealistic and inconsistent with her everyday experiences. While your negative thinking is probably not as extreme as hers, there may be many times every day when you do inadvertently ignore genuinely positive things that have happened to you. This removes much of life's richness and makes things appear needlessly bleak. Number 5. Jumping to conclusions. You arbitrarily jump to a negative conclusion that is not justified by the facts of the situation. Two examples of this are mind reading and the fortune teller error. Mind reading. You make the assumption that other people are looking down on you, and you're so convinced about this that you don't even bother to check it out. Suppose you are giving an excellent lecture, and you notice that a man in the front row is nodding off. He was up most of the night on a wild fling, but you, of course, don't know this. You might have the thought, "This audience thinks I'm a bore." Suppose a friend passes you on the street and fails to say hello because he is so absorbed in his thoughts he doesn't notice you. You might erroneously conclude, "He is ignoring me, so he must not like me anymore." Perhaps your spouse is unresponsive one evening because he or she was criticized at work and is too upset to want to talk about it. Your heart sinks because of the way you interpret the silence. "He or she is mad at me. What did I do wrong?" You may then respond to these imagined negative reactions by withdrawal or counterattack. This self-defeating behavior pattern may act as a self-fulfilling prophecy and set up a negative interaction in a relationship when none exists in the first place. The fortune-teller error is as if you had a crystal ball that foretold only misery for you. You imagine that something bad is about to happen, and you take this prediction as a fact even though it is unrealistic. A high school librarian repeatedly told herself during anxiety attacks, "I'm going to pass out or go crazy." These predictions were unrealistic because she had never once passed out or gone crazy in her entire life. Nor did she have any serious symptoms to suggest impending insanity. During a therapy session, an acutely depressed physician explained to me why he was giving up his practice. "I realize I'll be depressed forever. My misery will go on, and I'm absolutely convinced that this or any treatment will be doomed to failure." This negative prediction about his prognosis caused him to feel hopeless. His symptomatic improvement soon after initiating therapy indicated just how off base his fortune-telling had been. Do you ever find yourself jumping to conclusions like these? Suppose you telephone a friend who fails to return your call after a reasonable time. You then feel depressed when you tell yourself that your friend probably got the message but wasn't interested enough to call you back. Your distortion? Mind reading. You then feel bitter and decide not to call back and check this out because you say to yourself, he'll think I'm being obnoxious if I call him back again. I'll only make a fool of myself. Because of these negative predictions, the fortune teller error, you avoid your friend and feel put down. 3 weeks later, you learn that your friend never got your message. All that stewing, it turns out, was just a lot of self-imposed hokum. Another painful product of your mental magic. Number 6, magnification and minimization. Another thinking trap you might fall into is called magnification and minimization, but I like to think of it as the binocular trick, because you are either blowing things up out of proportion or shrinking them. Magnification commonly occurs when you look at your own errors, fears, or imperfections and exaggerate their importance. My God, I made a mistake. How terrible. How awful. The word will spread like wildfire. My reputation is ruined. You're looking at your faults through the end of the binoculars that make them appear gigantic and grotesque. This has also been called catastrophizing because you turn commonplace negative events into nightmarish monsters. When you think about your strengths, you may do the opposite. Look through the wrong end of the binoculars so that things look small and unimportant. If you magnify your imperfections and minimize your good points, you're guaranteed to feel inferior. But the problem isn't you, it's the crazy lenses you're wearing. Number 7, emotional reasoning. You take your emotions as evidence for the truth. Your logic: I feel like a dud, therefore I am a dud. This kind of reasoning is misleading because your feelings reflect your thoughts and beliefs. If they are distorted, as is quite often the case, your emotions will have no validity. Examples of emotional reasoning include, I feel guilty, therefore I must have done something bad. I feel overwhelmed and hopeless, therefore my problems must be impossible to solve. I feel inadequate, therefore I must be a worthless person. I'm not in the mood to do anything, therefore I might as well just lie in bed. Or, I'm mad at you. This proves that you've been acting rotten and trying to take advantage of me. Emotional reasoning plays a role in nearly all your depressions. Because things feel so negative to you, you assume they truly are. It doesn't occur to you to challenge the validity of the perceptions that create your feelings. One usual side effect of emotional reasoning is procrastination. You avoid cleaning up your desk because you tell yourself, I feel so lousy when I think about that messy desk. Cleaning it will be impossible. 6 months later, you finally give yourself a little push and do it. It turns out to be quite gratifying and not so tough at all. You were fooling yourself all along because you are in the habit of letting your negative feelings guide the way you act. Number 8. Should statements. You try to motivate yourself by saying, I should do this or I must do that. These statements cause you to feel pressured and resentful. Paradoxically, you end up feeling apathetic and unmotivated. Albert Ellis calls this musturbation. I call it the shouldy approach to life. When you direct should statements toward others, you will usually feel frustrated. When an emergency caused me to be 5 minutes late for the first therapy session, the new patient thought, he shouldn't be so self-centered and thoughtless. He ought to be prompt. This thought caused her to feel sour and resentful. Should statements generate a lot of unnecessary emotional turmoil in your daily life? When the reality of your own behavior falls short of your standards, your shoulds and shouldn'ts create self-loathing, shame, and guilt. When the all-too-human performance of other people falls short of your expectations, as will inevitably happen from time to time, you'll feel bitter and self-righteous. You'll either have to change your expectations to approximate reality or always feel let down by human behavior. If you recognize this bad should habit in yourself, I have outlined many effective should and shouldn't removal methods in later chapters on guilt and anger. Number 9, labeling and mislabeling. Personal labeling means creating a completely negative self-image based on your errors. It is an extreme form of overgeneralization. The philosophy behind it is, the measure of a man is the mistakes he makes. There's a good chance you are involved in a personal labeling whenever you describe your mistakes with sentences beginning with, "I'm a," for example. When you miss your putt on the 18th hole, you might say, "I'm a born loser," instead of, "I goofed up on my putt." Similarly, when the stock you invested in goes down instead of up, you might think, "I'm a failure," instead of, "I made a mistake." Labeling yourself is not only self-defeating, it is irrational. Yourself cannot be equated with any one thing you do. Your life is a complex and ever-changing flow of thoughts, emotions, and actions. To put it another way, you are more like a river than a statue. Stop trying to define yourself with negative labels. They are overly simplistic and wrong. Would you think of yourself exclusively as an eater just because you eat, or a breather just because you breathe? This is nonsense. But such nonsense becomes painful when you label yourself out of a sense of your own inadequacies. When you label other people, you will invariably generate hostility. A common example is the boss who sees his occasionally irritable secretary as an uncooperative bitch. Because of this label, he resents her and jumps at every chance to criticize her. She, in turn, labels him an insensitive chauvinist and complains about him at every opportunity. So, around and around they go at each other's throats, focusing on every weakness or imperfection as proof of the other's worthlessness. Mislabeling involves describing an event with words that are inaccurate and emotionally heavily loaded. For example, a woman on a diet ate a dish of ice cream and thought, "How disgusting and repulsive of me! I'm a pig!" These thoughts made her so upset, she ate the whole quart of ice cream. Number 10. Personalization. This distortion is the mother of guilt. You assume responsibility for a negative even when there is no basis for doing so. You arbitrarily conclude that what happened was your fault or reflects your inadequacy, even when you were not responsible for it. For example, when a patient didn't do a self-help assignment I had suggested, I felt guilty because of my thought, "I must be a lousy therapist. It's my fault that she isn't working harder to help herself. It's my responsibility to make sure she gets well." When a mother saw her child's report card, there was a note from the teacher indicating the child was not working well. She immediately decided, "I must be a bad mother. This shows how I've failed." Personalization causes you to feel crippling guilt. You suffer from a paralyzing and burdensome sense of responsibility that forces you to carry the whole world on your shoulders. You have confused influence with control over others. In your role as a teacher, counselor, parent, physician, salesman, executive, you will certainly influence the people you interact with. But no one could reasonably expect you to control them. What the other person does is ultimately his or her responsibility, not yours. Methods to help you overcome your tendency to personalize and trim your sense of responsibility down to manageable, realistic proportions will be discussed later on in this book. The 10 forms of cognitive distortions cause many, if not all, of your depressed states. They are summarized in Table 3.1, found on the enhancement. Study this table and master these concepts. Try to become as familiar with them as with your phone number. Refer to Table 3.1 over and over again as you learn about the various methods for mood modification. When you become familiar with these 10 forms of distortion, you will benefit from this knowledge all your life. I have prepared a simple self-assessment quiz to help you test and strengthen your understanding of the 10 distortions. As you read each of the following brief vignettes, imagine you are the person who is being described. Circle one or more answers, which indicate the distortions contained in the negative thoughts. I will explain the answer to the first question. The answer key to subsequent questions is given at the end of this chapter, but don't look ahead. I'm certain you will be able to identify at least one distortion in the first question, and that will be a start. 1. You are a housewife and your heart sinks when your husband has just complained disgruntledly that the roast beef was overdone. The following thought crosses your mind. "I'm a total failure. I can't stand it. I never do anything right. I work like a slave, and this is all the thanks I get? The jerk." These thoughts cause you to feel sad and angry. Your distortions include one or more of the following. A. All-or-nothing thinking. B. Overgeneralization. C. Magnification. D. Labeling. E. All of the above. Now I will discuss the correct answers to this question so you can get some immediate feedback. Any answer you might have circled was, were, correct, so if you circled anything, you were right. Here's why. When you tell yourself, I'm a total failure, you engage in all-or-nothing thinking. Cut it out. The meat was a little dry, but that doesn't make your entire life a total failure. When you think, I never do anything right, you are overgeneralizing. Never? Come on now. Not anything? When you tell yourself, I can't stand it, you are magnifying the pain you are feeling. You're blowing it way out of proportion because you are standing it. And if you are, you can. Your husband's grumbling is not exactly what you like to hear, but it's not a reflection of your worth. Finally, when you proclaim, I work like a slave and this is all the thanks I get, the jerk, you are labeling both of you. He's not a jerk, he's just being irritable and insensitive. Jerky behavior exists, but jerks do not. Similarly, it's silly to label yourself a slave. You're just letting his moodiness sour your evening. Okay, now let's continue with the quiz. Number two, you have just read the sentence in which I informed you that you would have to take this self-assessment quiz. Your heart suddenly sinks and you think, oh no, not another test. I always do lousy on tests. I'll have to skip this section of the book. It makes me nervous, so it wouldn't help anyway. Your distortions include A, jumping to conclusions, fortune teller error, B, overgeneralization, C, all-or-nothing thinking, D, personalization, E, emotional reasoning. 3. You are a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania. You are attempting to revise your manuscript on depression after meeting with your editor in New York. Although your editor seemed extremely enthusiastic, you notice you are feeling nervous and inadequate due to your thoughts. They made a terrible mistake when they chose my book. I won't be able to do a good job. I'll never be able to make the book fresh, lively, and punchy. My writing is too drab and my ideas aren't good enough. Your cognitive distortions include A, all-or-nothing thinking, B, jumping to conclusions, negative prediction, C, mental filter, D, disqualifying the positive, E, magnification. Number 4. You are lonely and you decide to attend a social affair for singles. Soon after you get there, you have the urge to leave because you feel anxious and defensive. The following thoughts run through your mind. They probably aren't very interesting people. Why torture myself? They're just a bunch of losers. I can tell because I feel so bored. This party will be a drag. Your errors involve A, labeling, B, magnification, C, jumping to conclusions, fortune teller error and mind reading, D, emotional reasoning, E, personalization. Number 5. You receive a layoff notice from your employer. You feel mad and frustrated. You think, this proves the world is no damn good. I never get a break. Your distortions include A, all-or-nothing thinking, B, disqualifying the positive, C, mental filter, D, personalization, E, should statement. Number 6. You're about to give a lecture and you notice that your heart is pounding. You feel tense and nervous because you think, my God, I'll probably forget what I'm supposed to say. My speech isn't any good anyway. My mind will blank out. I'll make a fool of myself. Your thinking errors involve A, all-or-nothing thinking, B, disqualifying the positive, C, jumping to conclusions, fortune teller error, D, minimization, E, labeling. Number 7. Your date calls you at the last minute to cancel out because of illness. You feel angry and disappointed because you think, I'm getting jilted. What did I do to foul things up? Your thinking errors include A, all-or-nothing thinking, B, should statements, C, jumping to conclusions, mind reading, D, personalization, E, overgeneralization. Number 8. You have put off writing a report for work. Every night when you try to get down to it, the whole project seems so difficult that you watch TV instead. You begin to feel overwhelmed and guilty. You are thinking the following. I'm so lazy, I'll never get this done. I just can't do the darn thing. It would take forever. It won't turn out right anyway. Your thinking errors include A, jumping to conclusions, fortune teller error, B, overgeneralization, C, labeling, D, magnification, E, emotional reasoning. Number 9. You've read this entire book, and after applying the methods for several weeks, you begin to feel better. Your BDC score went down from 26, moderately depressed, to 11, borderline depression. Then you suddenly begin to feel worse, and in 3 days your score has gone back up to 28. You feel disillusioned, hopeless, bitter, and desperate due to thinking, I'm not getting anywhere. These methods won't help me after all. I should be well by now. That improvement was a fluke. I was fooling myself and I thought I was feeling better. I'll never get well. Your cognitive distortions include A. Disqualifying the positive. B. Should statement. C. Emotional reasoning. D. All or nothing thinking. E. Jumping to conclusions. Negative prediction. Number 10. You've been trying to diet. This weekend, you've been nervous, and since you didn't have anything to do, you've been nibbling. After your fourth piece of candy, you tell yourself, I just can't control myself. My dieting and jogging all week have gone down the drain. I must look like a balloon. I shouldn't have eaten that. I can't stand this. I'm going to pig out all weekend. You begin to feel so guilty you push another handful of candy into your mouth in an abortive effort to feel better. Your distortions include A. All or nothing thinking. B. Mislabeling. C. Negative prediction. D. Should statement. E. Disqualifying the positive. Feelings aren't facts. At this point, you may be asking yourself, okay, I understand that my depression results from my negative thoughts because my outlook on life changes enormously when my moods go up or down. But if my negative thoughts are so distorted, how do I continually get fooled? I can think as clearly and realistically as the next person. So if what I'm telling myself is irrational, why does it seem so right? Even though your depressing thoughts may be distorted, they nevertheless create a powerful illusion of truth. Let me expose the basis for the deception in blunt terms. Your feelings are not facts. In fact, your feelings, per se, don't even count, except as a mirror of the way you are thinking. If your perceptions make no sense, the feelings they create will be as absurd as the images reflected in the trick mirrors at an amusement park. But these abnormal emotions feel just as valid and realistic as the genuine feelings created by undistorted thoughts, so you automatically attribute truth to them. This is why depression is such a powerful form of mental black magic. Once you invite depression through an automatic series of cognitive distortions, your feelings and actions will reinforce each other in a self-perpetuating vicious cycle. Because you believe whatever your depressed brain tells you, you find yourself feeling negative about almost everything. This reaction occurs in milliseconds, too quickly for you even to be aware of it. The negative emotion feels realistic and in turn lends an aura of credibility to the distorted thought which created it. The cycle goes on, and you are eventually trapped. The mental prison is an illusion, a hoax you have inadvertently created. But it seems real because it feels real. What is the key to releasing yourself from your emotional prison? Simply this. Your thoughts create your emotions. Therefore, your emotions cannot prove that your thoughts are accurate. Unpleasant feelings merely indicate that you are thinking something negative and believing it. Your emotions follow your thoughts just as surely as baby ducks follow their mother. But the fact that the baby ducks follow faithfully along doesn't prove that the mother knows where she is going. Let's examine your equation. I feel, therefore I am. This attitude that emotions reflect a kind of self-evident ultimate truth is not unique to depressed people. Most psychotherapists today share the conviction that becoming more aware of your feelings and expressing them more openly represent emotional maturity. The implication is that your feelings represent a higher reality, a personal integrity, a truth beyond question. My position is quite different. Your feelings, per se, are not necessarily special at all. In fact, to the extent that your negative emotions are based on mental distortions, as is all too often the case, they can hardly be viewed as desirable. Do I mean you should get rid of all emotions? Do I want you to turn into a robot? No. I want to teach you to avoid painful feelings based on mental distortions because they are neither valid nor desirable. I believe that once you have learned how to perceive life more realistically, you will experience an enhanced emotional life with a greater appreciation for genuine sadness, which lacks distortion, as well as joy. As you go on to the next sections of this book, you can learn to correct the distortions that fool you when you are upset. At the same time, you will have the opportunity to reevaluate some of the basic values and assumptions that create your vulnerability to destructive mood swings. I have outlined the necessary steps in detail. The modifications in illogical thinking patterns will have a profound effect on your moods and increase your capacity for productive living. Now let's go ahead and see how we can turn your problems around. Part 2. Practical Applications. Chapter 4. Start by Building Self-Esteem. When you are depressed, you invariably believe that you are worthless. The worse the depression, the more you feel this way. You are not alone. A survey by Dr. Aaron Beck revealed that over 80% of depressed patients expressed self-dislike. Furthermore, Dr. Beck found that depressed patients see themselves as deficient in the very qualities they value most highly: intelligence, achievement, popularity, attractiveness, health, and strength. He said a depressed self-image can be characterized by the four D's. You feel defeated, defective, deserted, and deprived. Almost all negative emotional reactions inflict their damage only as a result of low self-esteem. A poor self-image is the magnifying glass that can transform a trivial mistake or an imperfection into an overwhelming symbol of personal defeat. For example, Eric, a first-year law student, feels a sense of panic in class. When the professor calls on me, I'll probably goof up. Although Eric's fear of goofing up was foremost on his mind, my dialogue with him revealed that a sense of personal inadequacy was the real cause of the problem. David, suppose you did goof up in class. Why would that be particularly upsetting to you? Why is that so tragic? Eric, then I would make a fool of myself. Suppose you did make a fool of yourself. Why would that be upsetting? Because then everyone would look down on me. Suppose people did look down on you. What then? Then I would feel miserable. Why? Why is it that you would have to feel miserable if people were looking down on you? Well, that would mean I wouldn't be a worthwhile person. Furthermore, it might ruin my career. I'd get bad grades and maybe I could never be an attorney. Suppose you didn't become an attorney. Let's assume, for the purposes of discussion, that you did flunk out. Why would that be particularly upsetting to you? That would mean that I had failed at something I've wanted all my life. And what would that mean to you? Life would be empty. It would mean I was a failure. It would mean I was worthless. In this brief dialogue, Eric showed that he believed it would be terrible to be disapproved of, or to make a mistake, or to fail. He seemed convinced that if one person looked down on him, then everyone would. It was as if the word reject would suddenly be stamped on his forehead for everyone to see. He seemed to have no sense of self-esteem that was not contingent upon approval and/or success. He measured himself by the way others looked at him and by what he had achieved. If his cravings for approval and accomplishment were not satisfied, Eric sensed he would be nothing because there would be no true support from within. If you feel that Eric's perfectionist drive for achievement and approval is self-defeating and unrealistic, you are right. But to Eric, this drive was realistic and reasonable. If you are now depressed or have ever been depressed, you may find it much harder to recognize the illogical thinking patterns which cause you to look down on yourself. In fact, you are probably convinced that you really are inferior or worthless, and any suggestion to the contrary is likely to sound foolish and dishonest. Unfortunately, when you are depressed, you may not be alone in your conviction about your personal inadequacy. In many cases, you will be so persuasive and persistent in your maladaptive belief that you are defective and no good, you may lead your friends, family, and even your therapist into accepting this idea of yourself. For many years, psychiatrists have tended to buy into the negative self-evaluation system of depressed individuals without probing the validity of what the patients are saying about themselves. This is illustrated in the writings of such a keen observer as Sigmund Freud in his treatise Mourning and Melancholia, which forms the basis for the orthodox psychoanalytic approach to treating depression. In this classic study, Freud said that when the patient says he is worthless, unable to achieve, and morally despicable, he must be right. Consequently, it was fruitless for the therapist to disagree with the patient. Freud believed the therapist should agree that the patient is, in fact, uninteresting, unlovable, petty, self-centered, and dishonest. These qualities describe a human being's true self, according to Freud, and the disease process simply makes the truth more obvious. The patient represents his ego to us as worthless, incapable of any achievement, and morally despicable. He reproaches himself, vilifies himself, and expects to be cast out and punished. It would be equally fruitless from a scientific and therapeutic point of view to contradict a patient who brings these accusations against his ego. He must surely be right in some way, emphasis mine, and be describing something that is, as it seems, to him to be. Indeed, we must at once confirm some of his statements without reservation. He really is as lacking in interest and incapable of love and achievement as he says. Emphasis mine. He also seems to us justified in certain other self-accusations. It is merely that he has a keener eye for the truth than other people who are not melancholic. Emphasis mine. When in his heightened self-criticism he describes himself as petty, egoistic, dishonest, lacking in independence, one whose sole aim has been to hide the weaknesses of his own nature. It may be so far as we know that he has come pretty near to understanding himself. Emphasis mine. We only wonder why a man has to be ill before he can be accessible to truth of this kind. Sigmund Freud, Mourning and Melancholia. The way a therapist handles your feelings of inadequacy is crucial to the cure, as your sense of worthlessness is a key to depression. The question also has considerable philosophical relevance. Is human nature inherently defective? Are depressed patients actually facing the ultimate truth about themselves? And what, in the final analysis, is the source of genuine self-esteem? This, in my opinion, is the most important question you will ever confront. First, you cannot earn worth through what you do. Achievements can bring you satisfaction, but not happiness. Self-worth based on accomplishments is a pseudo-esteem, not the genuine thing. My many successful but depressed patients would all agree. Nor can you base a valid sense of self-worth on your looks, talent, fame, or fortune. Marilyn Monroe, Marth Rothko, Freddie Prinz, and a multitude of famous suicide victims attest to this grim truth. Nor can love, approval, friendship, or a capacity for close, caring human relationships add one iota to your inherent worth. The great majority of depressed individuals are in fact very much loved, but it doesn't help one bit because self-love and self-esteem are missing. At the bottom line, only your own sense of self-worth determines how you feel. So, you may now be asking with some exasperation, how do I get a sense of self-worth? The fact is, I feel damn inadequate, and I'm convinced I'm really not as good as other people. I don't believe there's anything I can do to change those rotten feelings because that's the way I basically am. One of the cardinal features of cognitive therapy is that it stubbornly refuses to buy into your sense of worthlessness. In my practice, I lead my patients through a systemic reevaluation of their negative self-image. I raise the same question over and over again. Are you really right when you insist that somewhere inside you are essentially a loser? The first step is to take a close look at what you say about yourself when you insist you are no good. The evidence you present in defense of your worthlessness will usually, if not always, make no sense. This opinion is based on a recent study by Drs. Aaron Beck and David Braff, which indicated that there is actually a formal thinking disturbance in depressed patients. Depressed individuals were compared with schizophrenic patients and with undepressed persons in their ability to interpret the meaning of a number of proverbs, such as, "A stitch in time saves nine." Both the schizophrenic and depressed patients made many logical errors and had difficulty in extracting the meaning of the proverbs. They were overly concrete and couldn't make accurate generalizations, although the severity of the defect was obviously less profound and bizarre in the depressed patients than in the schizophrenic group. The depressed individuals were clearly abnormal as compared with the normal subjects. In practical terms, the study indicated that during periods of depression, you lose some of your capacity for clear thinking. You have trouble putting things into proper perspective. Negative events grow in importance until they dominate your entire reality, and you can't really tell that what is happening is distorted. It all seems very real to you. The illusion of hell you create is very convincing. The more depressed and miserable you feel, the more twisted your thinking becomes, and conversely, in the absence of mental distortion, you cannot experience low self-worth or depression. What types of mental errors do you make most generally when you look down on yourself? A good place to begin is with the list of distortions you began to master in Chapter 3. The most usual mental distortion to look out for when you are feeling worthless is all-or-nothing thinking. If you see life only in such extreme categories, you will believe your performance will be either great or terrible. Nothing else will exist. As a salesman told me, achieving 95% or better of my goal for monthly sales is acceptable. 94% or below is the equivalent of total failure. Not only is this all-or-nothing system of self-evaluation highly unrealistic and self-defeating, it creates overwhelming anxiety and frequent disappointment. A depressed psychiatrist who was referred to me noticed a lack of sexual drive and a difficulty in maintaining erections during a 2-week period when he was feeling blue. His perfectionistic tendencies had dominated not only his illustrious professional career, but also his sexual life. Consequently, he had intercourse regularly with his wife every other day, precisely on schedule for the 20 years of their married life. In spite of his decreased sex drive, which is a common symptom of depression, he told himself, "I must continue to perform intercourse on schedule." This thought created such anxiety that he became increasingly unable to achieve a satisfactory erection. Because his perfect intercourse track record was broken, he now began clubbing himself with the nothing side of his all-or-nothing system and concluded, "I'm not a full marriage partner anymore. I'm a failure as a husband. I'm not even a man. I'm a worthless nothing." Although he was a competent and some might even say brilliant psychiatrist, he confided to me tearfully, "Dr. Burns, you and I both know it is an undeniable fact that I will never be able to have intercourse again." In spite of his years of medical training, he could actually convince himself of such a thought. Overcoming the sense of worthlessness. By now you might be saying, "Okay, I can see that there is a certain illogic which lurks behind the sense of worthlessness, at least for some people. But they are basically winners. They're not like me. You seem to be treating famous physicians and successful businessmen. Anyone could have told you that their lack of self-esteem was illogical. But I really am a mediocre nothing. Others are, in fact, better looking and more popular and successful than I am. So what can I do about it? Nothing, that's what. My feeling of worthlessness is very valid. It's based on reality. So there is little consolation in being told to think logically. I don't think there's any way to make these awful feelings go away unless I try to fool myself, and you and I both know that won't work." Let me first show you a couple of popular approaches used by many therapists, which I feel do not represent satisfactory solutions to your problem of worthlessness. Then I'll show you some approaches that will make sense and help you. In keeping with the belief that there is some deep truth in your conviction you are basically worthless, some psychotherapists may allow you to ventilate these feelings of inadequacy during a therapy session. There is undoubtedly some benefit to getting such feelings off your chest. The cathartic release may sometimes, but not always, result in a temporary mood elevation. However, if the therapist does not provide objective feedback about the validity of your self-evaluation, you may conclude that he agrees with you, and you may be right. You may, in fact, have fooled him as well as yourself. As a result, you probably will feel even more inadequate. Prolonged silences during therapy sessions may cause you to become more upset and preoccupied with your critical internal voice, much like a sensory deprivation experiment. This kind of non-directive therapy in which the therapist adopts a passive role frequently produces greater anxiety and depression for the patient. And even when you do feel better as a result of achieving emotional release with an empathetic and caring therapist, the sense of improvement is likely to be short-lived if you haven't significantly transformed the way you evaluate yourself and your life. Unless you substantially reverse your self-defeating thinking and behavior patterns, you are likely to slip back again into depression. Just as emotional ventilation for its own sake is usually not enough to overcome the sense of worthlessness, insight and psychological interpretation generally don't help either. For example, Jennifer was a writer who came for treatment for panic she experienced before publication of her novel. In the first session she told me, "I have been to several therapists. They have told me that my problem is perfectionism and impossible expectations and demands on myself. I also have learned that I probably picked up this trait from my mother, who is compulsive and perfectionistic. She can find 19 things wrong with an incredibly clean room. I always tried to please her, but rarely felt I succeeded, no matter how well I did. Therapists have told me, stop seeing everyone as your mother. Stop being so perfectionistic. But how do I do this? I'd like to, I want to, but no one ever was able to tell me how to go about it." Jennifer's complaint is one I hear nearly every day in my practice. Pinpointing the nature or origin of your problem may give you insight, but usually fails to change the way you act. That is not surprising. You have been practicing for years and years the bad mental habits that helped create your low self-esteem. It will take systematic and ongoing effort to turn the problem around. Does a stutterer stop stuttering because of his insight into the fact that he doesn't vocalize properly? Does a tennis player's game improve just because the coach tells him he hits the ball into the net too often? Since ventilation of emotions and insight, the two staples of the standard psychotherapeutic diet, won't help, what will? As a cognitive therapist, I have three aims in dealing with your sense of worthlessness. A rapid and decisive transformation in the way you think, feel, and behave. These results will be brought about in a systematic training program that employs simple, concrete methods you can apply on a daily basis. If you are willing to commit some regular time and effort to this program, you can expect success proportionate to the effort you put in. Are you willing? If so, we've come to the beginning. You're about to take the first crucial step toward an improved mood and self-image. I have developed many specific and easily applied techniques that can help you develop your sense of worth. As you read the following sections, keep in mind that simply reading them is not guaranteed to bolster your self-esteem, at least not for long. You will have to work at it and practice the various exercises. In fact, I recommend that you set some time aside each day to work at improving your self-image, because only in this way can you experience the fastest and most enduring personal growth. Specific methods for boosting self-esteem. Talk back to that internal critic. A sense of worthlessness is created by your internal self-critical dialogue. It is self-degrading statements such as, "I'm no damn good," "I'm a shit," "I'm inferior to other people," and so on, that create and feed your feelings of despair and poor self-esteem. In order to overcome this bad mental habit, three steps are necessary. A. Train yourself to recognize and write down the self-critical thoughts as they go through your mind. B. Learn why these thoughts are distorted. And C. Practice talking back to them so as to develop a more realistic self-evaluation system. One effective method for accompanying this is the triple column technique. Simply draw two lines down the center of a piece of paper to divide it into thirds. You'll find an example of what I mean by seeing figure 4-1 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Label the left-hand column automatic thoughts, self-criticism, the middle column cognitive distortion, and the right-hand column rational response, self-defense. In the left-hand column, write down all those hurtful self-criticisms you make when you are feeling worthless and down on yourself. Suppose, for example, you suddenly realize you're late for an important meeting. Your heart sinks, and you're gripped with panic. Now ask yourself, what thoughts are going through my mind right now? What am I saying to myself? Why is this upsetting me? Then write these thoughts down in the left-hand column. You might have been thinking, "I never do anything right, and I'm always late." Write these thoughts down in the left-hand column and number them. See figure 4-1. You might also have thought, "Everyone will look down at me. This shows what a jerk I am." Just as fast as these thoughts cross your mind, jot them down. Why? Because they are the very cause of your emotional upset. They rip away at you like knives tearing into your flesh. I'm sure you know what I mean because you felt it. What's the second step? You already began to prepare for this when you read Chapter 3. Using the list of 10 cognitive distortions, page 42, see if you can identify the thinking errors in each of your negative automatic thoughts. For instance, I never do anything right is an example of overgeneralization. Write this down in the middle column. Continue to pinpoint the distortions in your other automatic thoughts as shown in Figure 4.1. You are now ready for the crucial